Welcome to today's deep dive. If you're joining us right now, it's probably because you have that same insatiable curiosity we do about how the world actually works behind the headlines.
Right, yeah, behind the sound bites.
Exactly. Because today, we are setting out on a very specific mission for you. We are exploring an intense, real-time legal battle. And it's laying out right now between two things that we all fundamentally value.
Which makes it so difficult, right?
It really does. On one side, we have public transparency, and on the other, police operational security.
Right.
And I can promise you, this is not going to be the standard talking points you see debated on social media.
No, it rarely is when you actually look at the legal mechanics. This is one of those topics where society has seemingly just drawn a line in the sand. I mean, people tend to just pick a side, dig their heels in, and shout.
Yeah, the nuance just vanishes.
Completely vanishes. But the reality, as we're going to see by tearing into our source material today, is incredibly complex. It really forces us to ask what happens when a seemingly black and white civil right walks into a very gray, highly volatile room.
Right. And to guide us through this maze, we are looking at a brand new piece of source material for you. This is a legal commentary published today, March 7, 2026.
Hot off the presses.
Literally today. And it's titled, A Right to Record is Not a Right to Disrupt Police Operations. Now, before we even touch the legal arguments, we need to ask who is actually making this argument, because the author profile here is what completely hooked me.
Oh, absolutely. It provides a massive aha moment right out of the gate, because the author is Eric Sanders, and his background is really what gives this commentary such incredible weight.
Yeah, tell us about him.
So Sanders is a former NYPD officer who retired and then, well, he completely shifted gears. He went to law school and became a civil rights attorney, but he doesn't just work on the fringes or, you know, write academic papers.
He's in the trenches.
Exactly. He is actively litigating against public institutions. And very specifically, he sues the NYPD.
Okay, let's linger on that for a second, because this is a vital piece of context.
Yeah.
If you look at the sidebar notes on his publication today, you see a whole list of his recent and ongoing work.
Right.
He is currently handling massive lawsuits against the city involving allegations of gender discrimination within the ranks, arrest record bias, political favoritism.
He's also done extensive work pushing for the implementation and proper use of body-worn cameras.
Right. So this is a person who has dedicated his entire post-police career to being a fierce, relentless advocate for public accountability.
Which is precisely why his perspective here is so compelling. I mean, he is not someone anyone could credibly accuse of being an apologist for police misconduct.
No, not at all.
He literally makes his living holding the department's feet to the fire, you know, breaking through the blue wall of silence in federal court.
Yeah.
So when a former cop turned aggressive civil rights litigator steps up to publish a piece arguing that the public debate about recording the police has, well, lost its nuance and gone off the rails, you really have to stop and listen to the architecture of his argument.
You really do. Now, speaking of his argument, I want to pause for a second and speak directly to you, our listener.
Very important point here.
Yeah. As we go through this deep dive today, we are going to be impartially reporting on Eric Sanders's legal arguments and the specific content provided in this source material. I want to make you crystal clear right up front that neither of us here is endorsing any political viewpoints.
Right. Pro-police, anti-police, or otherwise.
Exactly.
Sure.
We aren't taking a side in this debate. Our job today is strictly to convey the complex legal ideas and the highly debated concepts contained in the original material. We are here to explore the anatomy of the law, nothing more. Okay, let's unpack this.
So to really understand the tension Sanders is highlighting, we have to start by setting the baseline. We need to look back at the legislation that sparked this entire conversation.
The 2020 laws, right?
Right. In 2020, the legal landscape in New York changed significantly. The state enacted the New York State Right to Record Act, and almost simultaneously, New York City implemented a parallel law of its own.
And what do these laws actually do on paper?
What they actually do is explicitly, unequivocally grant the public the statutory right to record law enforcement activity.
Okay, but for a layperson, what did that actually change on the ground? Because for a long time, citizens who pulled out their phones to film an arrest or a police interaction, they felt like they were operating in this really dangerous gray area.
Absolutely.
We all saw the viral videos where someone is filming and an officer approaches them and threatens to arrest them for interfering.
Even if they were standing 20 feet away.
Exactly.
And that was exactly the chilling effect the legislature was trying to cure. The 2020 laws put it down in black and white. You have the affirmative right to hit record. The ambiguity was supposed to be gone. But, and this is the massive caveat that the commentary points out right away, that right was never written by the legislature to be absolute.
Right, there's always a catch.
Within the very text of these laws, there is a built-in limitation.
I'm guessing this is where the friction starts. What is the limitation?
The legislation clearly states that nothing in the statute permits conduct that physically interferes with law enforcement activity or conduct that constitutes obstruction.
Yeah.
You have the right to document, but you do not have the right to get in the way of an official, lawful police function.
Okay, so you can stand back on the sidewalk and film a traffic stop.
Right.
But you can't jump in between the officer and the driver's side window to get a better camera angle for your social media feed.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these enactments matter deeply because they were designed to fundamentally strengthen public oversight.
Yeah.
They exist to protect the documentation of police conduct, which is a vital civil right in a modern democracy. Sanders himself notes that this is a critical safeguard for society.
So nobody's arguing against the core right.
Right. The debate we're looking at today isn't about whether those laws should exist or whether the public has a right to record police out on the street. That proposition is already baked into the cake. It's embedded in both the state and city statutes.
So if we have these laws that seem crystal clear on paper out on the street, where is this actually causing a constitutional crisis on the ground? Here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, this is the crux of the whole thing.
Yeah, because this current dispute is not about filming a police officer on a public sidewalk. It's not about filming an arrest in a city park or standing on the steps of City Hall with your smartphone out.
No.
The entire central conflict of the current case we are examining, which is called Reyes v. City of New York, is focused on a very specific, highly unique geography. We are talking about the publicly accessible lobbies of police station houses.
And this is the core clash. You have two competing realities colliding in a single enclosed room. On one hand, you have the public armed with the 2020 laws that say they have a statutory right to record law enforcement. On the other hand, you have the NYPD, which maintains a strict, long-standing anti-recording policy inside their physical facilities.
So it's a direct contradiction.
Exactly. The million-dollar question at the heart of Reyes v. City of New York is this. Do those broad 2020 right-to-record laws invalidate the NYPD's specific anti-recording policy the second you walk through the doors of a precinct lobby?
Let me play devil's advocate here for a second, because I think a lot of people listening might have this immediate reaction. A precinct lobby is a public building, right?
Sure.
It's funded by taxpayer dollars. The doors are unlocked. Anyone can walk in off the street. So why wouldn't a law that protects public recording apply in a public building?
And that is exactly the reaction Sanders addresses in the commentary. He talks about what he calls the absolutist voices surrounding this case.
The people who say it's black and white.
Yes. These are the commentators in the public sphere who look at the situation and say exactly what you just said. What's the problem? The acts say people can record police, period. End of story.
Right.
They view any attempt to stop someone from filming in a lobby as an illegal, blatant violation of the 2020 statutes.
It's an incredibly appealing argument because human nature makes us want a simple, clean rule. Record everywhere. It's easy to understand. But the source material drops a heavy reality check on this absolutist view, doesn't it?
It does. And it does so by looking at exactly what the Second Circuit Court of Appeals did with this case.
Which is a huge deal.
It's a massive deal. The Second Circuit is a highly influential federal court. If the law was as simple and absolute as those commentators claim, the Second Circuit would have just struck down the NYPD policy right then and there.
Right. They would have said the city's policy violates the state's 2020 law.
Exactly. But they didn't do that.
Wait. So a massive, highly influential federal court essentially just threw their hands up and said, we don't know. That seems wild to me. How often does a federal court just punt a decision like that?
It is rare, and it really shows you just how legally radioactive this debate actually is.
Yeah.
The Second Circuit looked at the 2020 statutes and ruled that the laws do not speak clearly on whether this right extends indoors, specifically into the lobbies of police station houses.
Interesting. So the law has a blind spot.
basically. They noted that New York state courts hadn't actually interpreted this specific scenario yet. And because this issue so heavily impacts fundamental state law enforcement interests, the federal court decided it wasn't their place to guess what the state legislature intended.
So what did they do instead?
They utilized a procedural tool called a certified question.
Okay, let's translate that for everyone listening. Mm. Think of a certified question like a referee in a football game going to the replay booth. But the replay booth is actually the state's highest court.
I like that.
The federal judge is looking at the state's playbook and saying, hey, this play isn't clearly defined in your rulebook. Before we make a sweeping federal ruling that completely upends your entire state system, can you tell us exactly how to interpret your own law?
That is a brilliant analogy. The Second Circuit reserved their decision and literally sent the question to Albany.
Wow.
Specifically to the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in the state. And the New York Court of Appeals has officially accepted that certified question for review.
That's huge.
It is. This isn't just bureaucratic shuffling. This is a federal court looking at a highly combustible local issue and saying, if we get this wrong, we compromise the safety of millions of people. New York, you need to define your own rules.
Right. So the biggest takeaway from this procedural posture
yeah.
is that the law, as it applies to precinct lobbies, is absolutely not settled.
Correct. Anyone saying otherwise is ignoring the reality of where this case is right now.
And to understand why the courts are struggling so heavily with this, we need to completely rethink our mental image of the space we are talking about.
Yes, the physical space itself is key.
Because for most of us, if we have never been inside a police precinct lobby, we are probably picturing a DMV waiting room. Right? Flickering fluorescent lights, terrible plastic chairs, someone arguing over a parking ticket, and a bunch of people just standing around looking bored.
That's the Hollywood version, sure.
Right. But the commentary forcefully shatters that image. A precinct lobby is not just a passive public waiting area.
Not even close. You really have to consider the intense human element that passes through those doors every single day. The author breaks down exactly who is standing in that lobby at any given moment.
Paint that picture for us.
Well, you have victims who have just experienced severe trauma coming in to report violent crimes. You have reluctant witnesses appearing to give statements against dangerous individuals. You have confidential informants entering the building to pass along intelligence.
Wow.
And you have distraught family members seeking assistance because a loved one is missing or going through a severe mental health crisis.
It's a highly charged environment.
Extremely. And on top of all that, you have police officers responding in real time to volatile, rapidly escalating situations right there by the front desk with individuals who might be intoxicated, armed, or aggressive.
When you paint that picture, when you actually visualize the chaos and the vulnerability in that room, suddenly the idea of someone standing in the corner, live streaming the entire room to the internet, takes on a very different, much darker context.
What's fascinating here is that the city didn't just make a theoretical what-if argument about this in court.
They brought receipts.
Exactly. According to the commentary, the Second Circuit noted that the city offered actual concrete evidence showing that recording inside station houses implicates severe privacy and safety concerns.
Right.
We are talking about the physical safety and the deep emotional privacy of highly vulnerable people.
Let's make that concrete for the listener.
Yeah.
Imagine being an undercover officer.
Yep.
You spent months building a fake persona to infiltrate a narcotics ring. You walk through the precinct lobby to quietly meet your handler, and someone sitting in a plastic chair is live streaming to 10,000 followers on Twitch under the guise of an open government audit.
It's a nightmare scenario.
Your cover isn't just blown. Your life is in immediate catastrophic danger. Or imagine being a survivor of domestic violence, finally working up the terrifying courage to walk into a precinct to ask for help, and realizing someone behind you with a smartphone is filming your worst, most humiliating moment for a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
That is the reality the city brought to the court.
And this brings us to the real sophisticated nuance of Sanders' argument. He is stepping in to translate this complex reality. He is saying, look, this isn't simply about police departments trying to hide their own misconduct behind a convenient private property label.
Which is the cynical view.
Right. And as a civil rights attorney who literally sues the police for a living, he knows better than anyone that sometimes safety concerns absolutely are used as a pretext by law enforcement to avoid accountability. He admits that outright in his writing.
I'm really glad he points that out because anyone who has watched the news over the last decade would immediately harbor that skepticism.
Yeah.
They would think, oh, the police just don't want cameras around so they can get away with whatever they want.
And Sanders validates that skepticism. But, he argues, just because a safety concern can be used as a pretext doesn't mean all safety concerns are fake.
Right.
That is a logical fallacy. Sometimes those concerns are entirely legitimate, deeply real, and solely aimed at protecting terrified victims and preserving the integrity of ongoing, incredibly dangerous investigations.
And that highlights the danger of the extreme absolutist commentary that the source material is pushing back against. The extreme view treats literally any limitation inside a precinct as presumptively illegal.
Yeah.
It assumes every single mention of privacy or safety by the NYPD is just a calculated lie to dodge transparency. But Sanders is arguing that our legal framework has to be smarter than that.
It has to be.
The law has to be capable of distinguishing between a police department trying to cover up an officer beating a suspect and a police department trying to protect a terrified witness giving a statement at the front desk.
Which brings us to the core challenge of jurisprudence. If you remove the department's ability to regulate recording in that specific lobby space, you are actively stripping away their ability to fulfill their basic duty of care to the public they serve.
So what does this all mean? How do we take these two incredibly valid competing realities, the absolute democratic necessity of public oversight and the absolute human necessity of protecting vulnerable people in a police station, and reconcile them?
This is where Sanders introduces his primary thesis. He calls for serious line drawing. He says we have to find a highly functional, legally rigorous middle ground. The rule for society cannot simply be record everywhere because, as we just established, that strips away every operational safeguard for people who desperately need police protection.
But I assume he also argues the rule cannot be record nowhere, right? Because giving the government unchecked discretion to just ban cameras whenever they feel like it invites the exact abuse the 2020 laws were written to stop.
Exactly. This raises an important question. How does the government protect the public's right to oversee police conduct while simultaneously preserving its ability to maintain order and protect human beings in those highly sensitive spaces where emergency police services are actively being delivered?
It's an incredibly fine line.
It is. How do you write a law that threads that exact needle?
And Sanders' takeaway, his ultimate message in this commentary, is that threading that needle requires incredibly hard work. It requires moving past catchy internet slogans and social media outrage.
Yeah, you can't legislate via tweet.
Right. His call to action is that this debate requires less theater and more legal discipline. We can't pretend the issue is already settled just because one side or the other wants it to be. The legal system is currently doing the heavy lifting to figure this out.
The certified question is sitting with the New York Court of Appeals right now. They are reviewing the briefs, looking at the 2020 legislation, and weighing the exact safety concerns we just discussed.
And what happens next?
Whatever they decide will become the controlling policy judgment for the entire state. But until they actually hand down that ruling, it is legally irresponsible for anyone, commentators, activists, or police, to act as though the boundaries of this law are perfectly clear.
It is a phenomenal reminder that the law isn't just words on a page. It is a living, breathing mechanism that has to constantly adjust to the messy, unpredictable realities of human life.
Absolutely.
You can write a broad, sweeping statute about transparency, but eventually that statute has to walk into a room filled with real people facing real crises, and the courts have to figure out how to make it work without causing collateral damage.
And that is the true value of a source like this. It forces us to elevate our thinking. It challenges us to look beyond the binary of good versus bad and grapple with the friction of competing rights.
And that brings us right back to you, listening to this deep dive. We started out today looking at what felt like a very simple concept, the right to record the police. But by unpacking the legal architecture of the source material, we've seen how catchy slogans like transparency at all costs can sound fantastic on a bumper sticker.
They usually do.
But they often fall apart entirely when they collide with the complex reality of the legal system and sheer human vulnerability. True accountability isn't just about turning on a smartphone camera. It's about knowing how to balance the necessity of oversight with the fundamental safety of the very people the system is supposed to protect.
It really leaves us with a profound paradigm shift to consider. In an era where every single person has a high-definition broadcasting device in their pocket at all times, how do we fundamentally redefine the boundary between a public space and a safe space when both exist in the exact same room?
That is a fantastic lingering question to leave you with today.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We love tearing into these sources, and we love that you bring your curiosity here to explore these deeply complex issues with us. Keep looking past the headlines, keep questioning the world around you, and we will see you next time.